I started a series last week, a little mini-series, on a topic that we in theology call apologetics. And apologetics, even though the word apology is in it, it's not really an apology, it's a defense. It's defending the gospel, defending what you believe. And last week, the defense was about the empty tomb. And we talked about that if the resurrection can be shown to be true, then Jesus Christ is Lord and Savior. And I provided some evidence last week of why the resurrection really occurred, why Jesus raised from the grave, all these witnesses, all this evidence that pointed to him as the Messiah. Today, I want to talk about something that's going to be a little more technical than that. Not that resurrection isn't somewhat technical. There's a lot of technical things to look at in the resurrection. But the question that I'm trying to get everybody to answer for themselves is, why do I believe what I believe? You know, there's blind faith. There's leaping into believing something without really using the mind that God gave you to evaluate what you believe in. God does not call us into a blind faith. He calls us into a faith where he provides all kinds of evidence that points us to him. He wants to make sure that we recognize him alone as our God. So some of you may have tried to get answers to these questions for yourselves. And some of this may be material you've already seen, some of it may not be. But what I'm trying to do today is present some information to you that will help reassure you that God is who he says he is, number one. Number two, so that you might have a message when you deal with other people that are searching for God. They come to you and say, do you believe that God exists? Why do you believe that God exists? I'm going to provide you with some tools today that you can use to help explain that to other people. That's what apologetics is about. There are three questions that I believe everybody, every human being asks. One is, who created the universe? Or how was the universe created? Why am I here? Actually, four. What is my purpose? And where do I go after I die? I think those four questions every human being asks themselves at one time or another. Has anybody asked any of those questions? I know I have. Those are questions that, unless you know God, they're very difficult to answer. Science has been trying to answer those questions by ruling God out of the equation. What science will tell you is that you cannot have God or miracles as part of this equation. So anytime we come up with a theory, there has to be scientific experiments that will prove how this takes place in a natural way without God. And so what you see in schools today and what you see all around you is evidence presented because that is the most logical thing if you don't have God in the mix. But when you bring God in the equation, it all makes sense. And without God, it makes very little sense. There are three arguments that I want to talk about today. And it has to do with creation. We call these the cosmological arguments. How did the universe begin? We've all heard of Stephen Hawking, the world-renowned physicist that passed away recently. And his big study was on quantum physics. And what he tried to show is how the universe began. And his last theory was that it was what they call a multiverse, where there are multiple universes that all spawned off together and somehow randomly our universe was created so that it could support life. So there's that argument. There's another argument about creation that has to do with evolution. Many of you have probably been taught in school what evolution is, right? That out of some random cells, all this life evolved into different things. Natural selection is what Darwinism defined it as, where over time organisms begin to develop into different species, complete different species. We call that macroevolution. And then there's another part of this besides evolution that points to creation called fine-tuning. That's another term you will hear, fine-tuning. And what that's all about is that the amount of intelligence needed to even create an atom and the complexity of the atom, there is no way that that came about by chance. In fact, DNA, if you look at DNA, it is code. It is literally a code that defines the life of that individual. And anytime there's intelligent code, there's an intelligent designer behind that code. And so these are all things that you may not know about that I want to present today in a way that hopefully is easy to understand, so that when somebody comes to you and says, how do you know that God exists? Here are three arguments that you have that you can talk about that are logical, that are scientifically proven. And so if you have your Bibles, would you guys turn to Genesis 1? We're going to look at the first chapter of Genesis, the very first book. Very first book, very first chapter in the Bible. So I'm going to go ahead and read this today because we got a lot of stuff to cover. So Genesis was a revelation of Moses. It was his understanding of how creation began. And what's so crazy about this is it's so accurate if you look at science. It's extremely accurate. A man thousands of years ago, before any science, before any technology, any of this stuff existed, Moses wrote this down. And it says this, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now the earth was formless and empty, darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. And God said, let there be light. And there was light. God saw that the light was good, and he separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And there was evening, and there was morning the first day. And God said, let there be a vault between the waters to separate water from water. So God made the vault and separated the water under the vault from the water above it. And it was so. God called the vault sky. And there was evening and there was morning the second day. And God said, let the water under the sky be gathered to one place, and let dry ground appear. And it was so. God called the dry ground land, and the gathered waters he called seas. And God saw that it was good. Then God said, let the land produce vegetation, seed-bearing plants and trees on the land that bear fruit with seed in it, according to their various kinds. And it was so. The land produced vegetation, plants bearing seed according to their kinds, and trees bearing fruit with seed in it according to their kinds. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening and there was morning the third day. And God said, let there be lights in the vault of the sky to separate the day from the night, and let them serve as signs to mark sacred times and days and years, and let them be lights in the vault of the sky to give light on the earth. And it was so. God made two great lights, the greater light to govern the day and the lesser light to govern the night. He also made the stars. God sent them in the vault of the sky to give light on the earth to govern the day and the night, and to separate light from darkness. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the fourth day. And God said, let the water teem with living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth across the vault of the sky. So God created the great creatures of the sea and every living thing with which the water teems and that move about in it according to their kinds, and every winged bird according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. God blessed him and said, be fruitful and increase in number and fill the water in the seas and let the birds increase on the earth. And there was evening and there was morning the fifth day. And God said, let the land produce living creatures according to their kinds, the livestock, the creatures that move along the ground, and the wild animals, each according to its kind. And it was so. God made the wild animals according to their kinds, the livestock according to their kinds, and all the creatures that move along the ground according to their kinds. And God saw that it was good. Then God said, let us make mankind in our image and our likeness, so that they may rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky, over the livestock and all the wild animals, and over all the creatures that move along the ground. So God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. God blessed them and said, be fruitful and increase in number, fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky and over every living creature that moves on the ground. Then God said, I give you every seed-bearing plant on the face of the whole earth and every tree that has fruit with seed in it. They will be yours for food. And to all the beasts of the earth and all the birds in the sky and all the creatures that move along the ground, everything that has the breath of life in it, I give every green plant for food, and it was so. God saw all that he had made, and it was very good, and there was evening and there was morning the sixth day. Now if we go to one more verse in chapter 2, it says, thus the heavens and the earth were completed in all their vast array. So this is what we call the creation story. If you see, there were many things that God made, multiple different plants, all kinds of living plants, all kinds of different creatures in the sea, all kinds of animals. He made humankind and said, you're going to rule over these things. We're the only thing in creation made in his image. That's why we have the intelligence and the morality built into us, the things that we have as human beings that differ us from the animals. Now, what science will tell you is that this is all by chance. So there's a cosmological argument, and this is a scientific argument that says that God doesn't exist. It argues the origin of the universe. Many of the secular scientists believed at one time that the universe was eternal. It meant it always existed. Then we have the Big Bang Theory. Many of you have probably heard the Big Bang Theory. Anybody know what that is?
This is a TV show, right?
It's a TV show?
Yeah. It's also the sudden creation, like boom.
Boom.
Gas and dust and boom.
Yep. So what it says is that there was a point in time where an explosion occurred and all these atoms and particles were spread out into the universe. And through that bang, all this stuff in the universe was created. The stars, the sun, the moon, the earth, the planets, everything was forced out and the universe began to expand. So that was the theory that many believed in for many, many years. And in the 1970s, a scientist by the name of William Craig Lane, became a very powerful apologetist. What he came up with was what we call the Kalam cosmological argument. And in a sense, it has a lot to do with the Big Bang, but it has an intelligent designer behind the Big Bang. And so what he's learned in this is that it's been proven, there's a theory that's been shown to be true, that something cannot exist without a cause. Something cannot exist without a cause. In other words, my iPhone or my Android wouldn't be here unless it had a cause, unless somebody had a reason for it to be here. So the universe had to have a reason to be here, and it couldn't exist unless there was a purpose behind it. And so if there has to be a purpose behind it and something had to create the universe, something transcendent, something bigger that's always been here had to be behind the creation of the universe. And so I want to play a short video for you that explains this in like 5 minutes. And I want you to really think about this while you watch this video.
It goes like this. Whatever begins to exist has a cause.
universe began to exist. Therefore, the universe has a cause. Is the first premise true? Let's consider. Believing that something can pop into existence without a cause is more of a stretch than believing in magic. At least with magic, you've got a hat and a magician. And if something can come into being from nothing, then why don't we see this happening all the time? No, everyday experience and scientific evidence confirm our first premise. If something begins to exist, it must have a cause. But what about our second premise? Did the universe begin? Or has it always existed? Atheists have typically said that the universe has been here forever. The universe is just there, and that's all. First, let's consider the second law of thermodynamics. It tells us the universe is slowly running out of usable energy, and that's the point. If the universe had been here forever, it would have run out of usable energy by now. The second law points us to a universe that has a definite beginning. This is further confirmed by a series of remarkable scientific discoveries. In 1950, Albert Einstein presented his general theory of relativity. This allowed us, for the first time, to talk meaningfully about the past history of the universe. Next, Alexander Friedman and Georges Lemaître, each working with Einstein's equations, predicted that the universe is expanding. Then in 1929, Edwin Hubble measured the redshift in light from distant galaxies. This empirical evidence confirmed not only that the universe is expanding, but that it sprang into being from a single point in the finite past. It was a monumental discovery, almost beyond comprehension. However, not everyone is fond of a finite universe, so it wasn't long before alternative models popped into existence. But one by one, these models failed to stand the test of time. More recently, three leading cosmologists, Alvin Bord, Alan Guth, and Alexander Vilenkin, proved that any universe which has on average been expanding throughout its history cannot be eternal in the past, but must have an absolute beginning. This even applies to the multiverse, if there is such a thing. This means that scientists can no longer hide behind a past eternal universe. There is no escape. They have to face the problem of a cosmic beginning. Any adequate model must have a beginning, just like the standard model. It's quite plausible then that both premises of the argument are true. This means that the conclusion is also true. The universe has a cause. And since the universe can't cause itself, its cause must be beyond the space-time universe. It must be spaceless, timeless, immaterial, uncaused, and unimaginably powerful. Much like God. The cosmological argument shows that, in fact, it is quite reasonable to believe that God does exist.
All right. Does that make sense? Do you guys understand that?
Yeah. Yeah, that's always been my comment when people say it just kind of popped into existence. Why is the thing still popping up? Right. And I love for a new car to pop into my driveway, but that's not going to happen. But you know, why are new animals popping up and new plants popping up? You know?
Is that on YouTube?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep. So this is a a highly debated topic among scientists, and the cosmological argument has stood its ground for many years now, the Coulomb cosmological argument. Now, there are still some atheists that say, well, that doesn't prove that there's a God. That doesn't prove, it could be multiple gods. And I'm like, well, if you're an atheist, how could there be multiple gods?
Yeah, either you believe it or you don't believe it.
So it's interesting, they're stretching at this point. They're really stretching to come up with an answer that doesn't point to a creator, okay? That's just one argument. One argument. Then you get in the argument of fine-tuning. To me, this is just mind-blowing, the fine-tuning argument. So you have Darwinism, the theory of evolution, And many secular scientists have come back and said there are many flaws with Darwinism. The evidence is not there in the fossil record. So what Darwin did is he used a fossil record to try and show evolution. And there are many holes in that record. And so besides that, fine-tuning goes to show you that there is something intelligent that had to create life. And so I want to show you the next clip, which is about fine-tuning, and this is really, really important.
These are the fundamental constants and quantities of the universe. Scientists have come to the shocking realization that each of these numbers has been carefully dialed to an astonishingly precise value, a value that falls within an exceedingly narrow, life-permitting range. If any one of these numbers were altered by even a hair's breadth, no physical, interactive life of any kind could exist anywhere. There'd be no stars, no life, no planets, no chemistry. Consider gravity, for example. The force of gravity is determined by the gravitational constant. If this constant varied by just 1 in 10 to the 60th parts, none of us would exist. To understand how exceedingly narrow this life-permitting range is, imagine a dial divided into 10 to the 60th increments. To get a handle on how many tiny points on the dial this is, compare it to the number of cells in your body, or the number of seconds that have ticked by since time began. If the gravitational constant had been out of tune by just one of these infinitesimally small increments, the universe would either have expanded and thinned out so rapidly that no stars could form and life couldn't exist, or it would have collapsed back on itself with the same result. No stars, no planets, and no life. Or consider the expansion rate of the universe. This is driven by the cosmological constant. A change in its value by a mere one part in 10 to the 120th parts would cause the universe to expand too rapidly or too slowly. In either case, the universe would again be life prohibiting. Or another example of fine-tuning. If the mass and energy of the early universe were not evenly distributed to an incomprehensible precision of 1 part in 10 to the 10 to the 123rd, the universe would be hostile to life of any kind. The fact is, our universe permits physical, interactive life only because these, and many other numbers, have been independently and exquisitely balanced on a razor's edge. Wherever physicists look, they see examples of fine-tuning. The remarkable fact is that the values of these numbers seem to have been very finely adjusted to make possible the development of life. If anyone claims not to be surprised by the special features that the universe has, he's hiding his head in the sand. These special features are surprising and unlikely. What is the best explanation for this astounding phenomenon? There are 3 live options. The fine-tuning of the universe is due to either physical necessity, chance, or design. Which of these options is the most plausible? According to this alternative, the universe must be life-permitting. The precise values of these constants and quantities could not be otherwise. But is this plausible? Is a life-prohibiting universe impossible? Far from it. It's not only impossible, it's far more likely than a life-permitting universe. The constants and quantities are not determined by the laws of nature. There's no reason or evidence to suggest that fine-tuning is necessary. How about chance? Did we just get really, 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 really lucky? No. The probabilities involved are so ridiculously remote as to put the fine-tuning well beyond the reach of chance. So, in an effort to keep this option alive, some have gone beyond empirical science and opted for a more speculative approach, known as the multiverse. They imagine a universe generator that cranks out such a vast number of universes that, odds are, life-permitting universes will eventually pop out. However, there's no scientific evidence for the existence of this multiverse. It cannot be detected, observed, measured, or proved. And the universe generator itself would require an enormous amount of fine-tuning. Furthermore, small patches of order are far more probable than big ones. So the most probable observable universe would be a small one inhabited by a single, simple observer. But what we actually observe is the very thing that we should least expect, a vast, spectacularly complex, highly ordered universe inhabited by billions of other observers. So even if the multiverse existed, which is a moot point, it wouldn't do anything to explain the fine-tuning. Given the implausibility of physical necessity or chance, the best explanation for why the universe is fine-tuned for life may very well be it was designed that way. A common sense interpretation of the facts suggests that a super intellect monkeyed with physics, and that there are no blind forces worth speaking about in nature. The numbers one calculates from the facts seem to me so overwhelming as to put this conclusion almost beyond question. There is for me powerful evidence that there is something going on behind it all. It seems as though somebody has fine-tuned nature's numbers to make the universe. The impression of design is overwhelming. The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. Day after day they pour forth speech. Night after night they reveal knowledge.
They don't teach this in schools. Maybe in a Christian school they do, but so how many of you have seen this before or seen this argument? Dan? You guys? It when you get into that kind of mathematics and you look at the amount of chance that's necessary for life to begin and the theories that are out there today. It is ridiculous. But when you take the God equation out, that's what you get. You get, it's got to be chance. We can't put God into the mix here, and therefore the best possible explanation is that this all happened by chance. It makes no sense.
The truth is they barely scratched the surface of the anthropic principle.
Right.
The most striking one to me is that an asteroid had to bounce off of the Earth at just such an angle that it created an orbit,
yep,
and became the moon, because without the moon you have no tides. Without the tides you have no movement of the ocean, and there is no oxygen.
That's right.
In everything. I mean, all these things had to have taken place in such an amazing way.
Yeah, if the sun was out of place by, you saw the numbers, or the moon, life would not exist, guys.
Well, they're always saying that if the sun gets tilted a tiny bit, just a teeny tiny fraction, life will have another ice age or something, because of the way that it shines exactly the way it's supposed to.
It's amazing. I mean, science, what science is doing is they are pointing to God.
Without realizing it, or wanting to say it.
Without wanting to. Wait a minute.
Upsetting a lot of people.
Well, it is upsetting a lot of people. But what happens is I get these questions from time to time by people that are searching, wanting to know about God. Well, you know, how do I know God exists? I start showing some of the evidence about the universe, the creation. Take them to Genesis 1. And so once you get them to start to realize that, yeah, there's got to be a transcendent being, something intelligent that started all this in the first place.
Well, then you've got all the planets that line up. Why were we put on the exact only planet where life could exist? I mean, you can't exist on either of any of the other planets.
Right.
But what about, are there other planets that have life?
Have we found any?
Not that I know of. But how can there not be?
So, my political science teacher, who has his master's, working on his doctorate, he was in class one day, and somebody in class made a comment mocking religious ways of the way creation of the earth. And he stopped because he is a logical person and blasted him for how foolish that was. Mm-hmm. And he was an atheist in himself, began spouting out the numbers, showing that exact picture. Right. And then started on his own defending the Bible, not any other religion. Right. Just went straight to the Christian view of it, defended the Christian view in the Bible for how it depicted things as science truly backing in no matter what people had said. And he's an atheist, mind you. He's totally made that clear in the past. And then when he realizes what he said out loud, he buried his face in his desk and didn't speak a word for the rest of class.
That's crazy.
And it was amazing, like, because when I told my dad, I was like, because everyone knows. At the end of the day, everyone knows.
Right.
You show it to anybody watching that video, no matter how smart you are, if you look at the scientific evidence and how specific these numbers are and how long numbers of one in billions and billions and trillions of odds, you can't argue that chance set that up.
There is an atheist biologist that is well known for his DNA genome studies. And I can't remember his name at the moment. But what he's concluded is that DNA is a computer program. It is a sequence of numbers that is intelligently placed and is a computer program. And he's stretching more and more, because what he's realizing is that something highly intelligent had to write that code and put it into place. And so there have been many apologists that have gone into debates with him, and you can see the man just becoming very stressed because he can't answer a lot of the questions, right? And so it's amazing when you just look at the DNA and the fine-tuning of DNA and the code, the intelligent code that's written in the DNA.
Well, everybody's is different, and everybody's iris is different. That's why they want to use to pinpoint who you are by recognition, facial recognition. Everybody's voice is different.
Yeah, we're all so unique.
But there's so many of us.
Right. So, science is just helping prove God out more and more, right?
Right, it's funny.
And so...
I know a few atheists, and they get so angry.
They get angry because it points them to God, and they don't want to believe in God.
They don't want to.
So the other thing is, if you read the story that we just read in detail in Genesis, and you look at the order of how creation occurred...
Makes total sense.
Life could not exist unless it was done in that order.
Right. You couldn't have created cattle before you created the earth.
Before the plants.
So it's science.
The water first, then the sun and the moon, the gravitational pull. The sun is needed for light to grow the plants and feed the animals. I mean, all of it is in such a perfect order, written thousands and thousands of years ago before any type of science was really available.
No, the most confusing for me was always the separation of the waters at the very beginning. And then later on in Genesis, you find out that the earth had never seen rain before Noah.
Right.
And now scientists are saying that the most probable model is that we had a canopy of water over the earth at one point, and it just all came down. And we know the story. Yeah. Science just says, I don't know, at some point it started
dropping. It all comes
dropping.
Back to Genesis, yeah.
So, and then now you get into the final topic I want to talk about, and that is evolution. Mm-hmm. There are two parts to evolution. There's macroevolution, where a new species is born out of a previous species. A whole new species is created. Science has never, ever been able to do that, by the way. The second one is what they call microevolution, and there is some theory to that we adapt to our surroundings in some way. There is some scientific evidence that suggests there's some level of microevolution that goes on. But what you'll find is more scientists than not, say that Darwinism has too many holes in it. Okay? But what are we teaching in schools?
Darwinism.
When we went to the history museums in D.C., what do we see? Evolution. That's all they were teaching. You go to the science...
They have a better theory.
Right. You go to the science museum, evolution. I want to play one more video, and this is really important to listen to.
So
he talks about
monkeys,
the whole...
Couldn't we still give birth to a monkey? I mean, somewhere else?
You might.
That was true. The monkeys didn't want to come along.
Just pay attention to the words in Genesis, according to their kind.
Right, right.
That's phyla. You'll never find any common ancestry below that.
Okay, I want to play this one video for you guys, and then we'll conclude with this one. Princeton University.
I understand, because we're not dealing with a theory in any sense in which, say, a physicist would recognize a theory. We're dealing with a collection of anecdotes, a certain point of view, a series of hunches. I would say that the most outstanding, the salient points are, first of all, the fossil record, which is simply mystifying. We can't make much sense of the fossil record. It does not sustain any kind of Darwinian prediction that can be intelligently derived from Darwinian theory. And it doesn't seem to sustain anything else, as far as I can see. It's a perfectly mystifying record. That's one obvious point. I'm not talking just about the Cambrian explosion. I'm talking about everything that doesn't make a whole lot of sense in the fossil record. Second point, we have never been able in any way theoretically to examine the central Darwinian claim that natural selection and random variation can account for a great deal of complexity. If you look at the history of physics, for example, what did Newton do in the 17th century? He said, well, the planets are being attracted to the sun by a force. It's not any kind of force, it's an inverse square force. And then he went and showed that if you make that assumption, the result will be an orbit that conforms exactly to the observed orbit, say, of the Earth or of Mars. It will be a conic section. And then he proved the converse, that if it's a conic section, the planets must be attracted to a central source by an inverse square law. There is nothing like that in biology, in Darwinian theory. A kind of a canonical demonstration that this mechanism, random variation, natural selection, is adequate to the generation of this level of complexity. From the point of view of the serious sciences, without that kind of a demonstration, one is completely adrift. You have no idea whether the mechanism is adequate for its intended purposes. This is the second point. Third evidential piece of the puzzle. Look, you turn to the serious sciences, you turn to general relativity of quantum mechanics. I can program a computer with the equations of general relativity, with the equations of quantum mechanics, and I can say, all right, what are the consequences? I can actually see the consequences emergent in a simulation. We can't do any of this in biology. And that should prompt any reasonable person to ask, why not? If this is such a simple mechanism, could easily be programmed on a computer. How come we can't set up a computer and create something of biological-like complexity? How come we cannot see the unfolding of an evolutionary process the way we can see the unfolding of an evolutionary process in physics? It's a very serious question. I've looked at all the genetic algorithms. I've tried to write a genetic algorithm myself. And the sheer fact is, without a tremendous amount of very special manipulation and ad hoc constraints, the computer is not going to generate anything realistic if it uses Darwinian mechanisms, and it will generate something realistic only if it doesn't use Darwinian mechanisms. This is an important point. 50 years after the computer revolution began, we have a splendid tool for assessing the intelligibility and viability of Darwinian theory. And everything that we know, I think this is the uniform experience of anyone working in genetic algorithms, indicates these mechanisms will not work. They will not work for their intended purposes. And finally, there's the utter absence of laboratory evidence. And random variation, natural selection, we should be able to start manipulating organisms. When we look at dogs, no matter how far back we go, it's dogs. When we look at bacteria, no matter what we do, they stay bugs. They don't change in their fundamental nature. There seems to be some sort of an inherent species limitation, and we have no good explanation for this in terms of Darwinian theory. We should have far more flexibility, far more plasticity under laboratory conditions than we actually do, if Darwinian theory or anything like that were correct. What we see in nature, what we see in the laboratory, is very highly bounded variation, cyclic variation. As for example, finch beaks in the Galapagos Islands. That's about all we see. Small variation. Why is that if Darwinian theory is correct? These are evidentiary points that I think need to be stressed, need to be examined openly, honestly. And they never are, of course. Never are.
That's just one explanation of many, many, many out there that science has said there's no evidence whatsoever of macroevolution. The fossil record doesn't exist well enough to be able to use that to point to macroevolution, and yet here we teach it to our children, we teach it in schools, and we believe that out of atoms randomly things began to exist, intelligent life with DNA and all these things. And it's meant to, again, it's a diversion. It's a delusion planted by Satan to steer us away from God. And so it's important that we have a somewhat of an understanding of these things. Number one, it strengthens our belief. It helps us realize why we believe in God. Two, it helps us to be able to share our faith and defend the gospel when we encounter people. Now, there's always going to be people that are not searching for God. They could care less. They don't want to know about God. They're just going to throw out a debate and get in a heated argument. I avoid those. I don't get involved in that. If there's somebody really searching for God and they want answers and they're open to listening, man, let's talk about it. Let me show you the evidence. Let me show you the facts. Here it is. And there are so many resources available today for free. If you have an internet connection, go search. Go search for the cosmological argument. Go search for Darwinism in the disproof of it. Go search for fine-tuning. There is so much stuff out there. You will be amazed. Yes?
Well, I just want to make a comment, too. While we talk about the design by the Creator and how we're all genetically computer systems and DNA, right, going forward, I would think that, you know, everybody's always like, well, how is there a blue-eyed person, a green-eyed person? Where did they come from? I would think that your genetic code created by God is within a cell, within a cell, within a cell. Like if I had a child, I produced certain things to have that child. That code's already there, but the creator of that child's going to have green eyes and red hair or blonde hair. And then when they have a child, that code's there, that they're going to have a different color or a different nose or ears. You know, that's just my...
It's combining code. Huh? It's combining code.
So how can that be happenstance?
Exactly. That's what,
yeah, it can't be.
The fact that there's code.
Yeah. Exactly.
And that code is written in every cell of your body.
That's right. That's right.
The tip of your hair has the code for your entire being.
Right.
My tip had it cut off soon.
If you start looking at the research in microbiology, the mechanics of a living cell, somebody described it as a machine. It is so well built, it's a machine. It is a fine-tuned, fine design machine.
Look at how our bodies work and function.
Right.
Maybe that's why culture is trying to teach young people that belief in God is anti-science. Because it's actually very scientific. That's why there is like going the opposite direction. Well, they don't believe in science. Because I've had atheists ask me, you don't believe in science? I said, why do you say that?
Of course,
that
would be wrong science.
Well, Dan and I were having this discussion. Your body was created to live 120 years. How do you think that happened? You know, it was created to live that long. You know, of course, with everything that happens with society, the way it runs, and, you know, all the stuff your body gets into, of course, your body was made to live that long. You're not guaranteed to live that long, but with everything that happens to you throughout your life, with all the, you know, all the chemicals you get into and all of this, maybe you're not made to live that long anymore, but you were told your body was made to live this long.
Yeah.
Nope. He gave you 120 years after the flood, that's it. Otherwise, people back before then lived 600,000, 700,000 years.
And that's a scientific explanation for what they say are fossils of early man with the pronounced ridge bones.
Mm-hmm.
And all that, mm-hmm. because that's a part of our body that never stops growing.
Right.
And that's probably fossils of people who live 600, 700
years.
Very
possible.
Never,
I mean, the evidence is so strong. Now, what you'll find also when you look on the internet is there are people that try and debunk these theories, the theories that point to God. If you watch them, listen to them carefully, because they're always a stretch. And the stretch is far more unlikely than to believe in God. Okay? They come up with these wild ideas and theories that cannot be proved whatsoever.
Well, I don't know why people listening to that don't just say it's easier to believe in God than it is to go through all this nonsense.
Many scientists are coming to that conclusion. I mean, many well-known scientists that were atheists before, they were brought up in the world of evolution, were brought up with these ideas that have really studied it and put it to a test and taken these theories. And now we have supercomputers where we can put these formulas in and model these things to see what the results would actually be. They're starting to say, I can't explain it.
I think it's the lack of study, the lack of actually digging and finding out for yourself that people just automatically believe someone told them.
Well, it's also the game is tilted. As many laughable holes as there are in Darwinism, mm-hmm. you walk into any place of higher learning and question Darwinism, you will be mocked as an idiot.
Mm-hmm. See, that's
because if you do not follow their doctrine,
right.
they shun you.
Right.
So there's no intellectual honesty. So you can't.
I think it depends on the professor and the school. Yeah, you know? There are cases like
there,
that.
There are many, like you say, who are becoming more and more convinced. But even in their sphere, when they come forth to their peers, they're mocked.
Right.
And it doesn't matter how well respected that scientist is.
Right.
When they come forward as a believer, they are mocked.
That's why it's interesting to watch the public debates on the topic. When you get a public debate, which there are many on YouTube you can go see, where they bring them to the table in front of an audience and they present the facts speak for themselves, and you usually have the atheist sitting there dumbfounded. I mean, every time I've seen it.
I agree.
So,
I have a question.
Yes.
Since we're on creation, and I'm sure I can Google this later and find it, but since we're on the subject, where in the Bible does it talk about the earth being a globe or a sphere? Because, you know, now there's the flat earth theory that everybody's falling for, and I'm like...
Well, yeah, that's a big thing, too.
What's that?
That the earth is flat. This one guy on some group was dogging me about something, and then I looked at his page, and it's all this flat earth, and...
How does the sun orbit a flat earth?
Well, it's all supposedly, it goes from side to side. It's all bogus. But I mean, I know there's somewhere in the Bible that it's got to be talked about how the earth is around.
I'm sure it is. I that's never even occurred to me as something to even debate.
I'm just like to know where it's at.
Gravity doesn't exist.
Yeah, gravity, you can't exist on a flat. There you go.
Yeah.
Anyone who's flown knows that the earth is.
Well, he had even a spark for that, too. But, I mean, every time there's something that I don't believe in, then I like to go in the Bible and find it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That is one fooled individual.
Yeah, exactly.
Man, so... I saw the there's an organization that's trying to prove the earth is flat, and there is a man that built his own spaceship.
Yeah.
And did you see that?
Yeah.
And hey, he's pretty smart, man. He built a spaceship that worked. It's like, wow. And and to me, I think he used the organization as a way to fund his spaceship.
Oh, you totally did.
Right. So he wasn't trying to prove the earth was flat. He's trying to get a rocket right.
The only part of Darwinism that bears any scrutiny is the survival of the fittest.
Right.
Those people are...
They're still here.
They'll take care of themselves eventually.
We hope some of them will eliminate themselves now.
Right.
But
at the end of the year, they get a war, right?
Stupidity is still here, guys. It's not gone away, right? So if the... That disproves that whole argument. So anyway, anybody have any other questions I can address? Do you guys, did this make sense? I know it's pretty technical. I know it's a lot of stuff that I shared in a Sunday morning. It wasn't a typical sermon. But I think it's very important to understand this.
I wish every church did that.
I wish they would too.
Well, I like the numbers part where it broke it down to how thin that actual line had to be, and the numbers had to be exactly correct in order for all this to happen.
It's pretty amazing. Try and calculate that on a calculator, you'll probably blow it up.
And don't even go that high.
Right. I mean, it's pretty phenomenal. So the evidence is there. You're either going to have a mindset that I am not going to believe in God, and I'm going to somehow come up with a theory that's going to disprove that God exists, and you're going to drive yourself nuts, or you're really searching and you will see that this all points to a creator. So you're foolish to think that we're here by chance. The reason you would think that is because I don't have to be accountable for anything.
Right.
So.
It's kind of depressing to think when you die, you go nowhere. I thought it would be just awful.
That's why you live it up. Live life. Enjoy life. You live it once. Wrong.
Well,
you don't.
You never. To me, you never actually die. Your body dies.
You have an eternal life, and where it goes is up to you. Right. So, well, let me go ahead and close this in prayer.